Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, December 8th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. After that, I'll read an article from Humanity Behind the Headlines, and then I'll read the explainer, followed by the Home Forum, and then the Monitor's View. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled Illuminating Humanity's Connections. This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who is a print editor, and you can email her at haness@csmonitor.com. And she writes, here in the Monitor newsroom, we talk a lot about what we put on the cover of our magazine. Editors choose stories we hope will expand readers' understanding of places and people, illuminate shifts in thought, and highlight moments of joy and love and humanity that are happening every day around the world. We also hope to give you really great stories to read. So when Africa editor Ryan Lenora Brown reached out about a piece that reporters Colette Davidson and Isoli Daidhayo had brought back from West Africa, we saw a chance to hit all these goals. Colette and Isoli traveled to Senegal and to part of the Canary Islands off the western coast of Africa. In this week's cover story, they tell the wrenching story of young people deciding whether to leave their home country in search of a better life, and of the Senegalese elders trying to convince them to stay. This question of staying or going and the forces underneath that decision run through other stories in the magazine this week. From the United States, writers Sarah Matusik and Victoria Hoffman explore the question of what constitutes a nation's border in their story about the U.S. Border Patrol expanding to inland American cities. Pieces from Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland show how residents are grappling with what home should mean. And reporter Patrick Johnson looks at the timber industry in Georgia and examines what happens when local identity and economy are whipsawed by large external economic forces. It's a situation that, if one peels back the layers, doesn't appear too foreign from the one facing young Senegalese fishers half a world away. I love how Monitor reporting illuminates these sorts of connections. We hope you, too, will read and feel closer to the other humans who share this beautiful world. And that was the From the Editor column this week, written by Stephanie Haynes, who is the print editor. And this week it was entitled Illuminating Humanity's Connections. And now for the cover story. Before I read this, I'll have to apologize in advance. This article is about Senegal people and places, and I will not pronounce the names of people and places correctly, most likely, but I'll do my best. Here we go. This is called Seeking a Better Life. Many Senegalese are braving dangerous seas to get to Europe. Can they be convinced to stay? This is written by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent, and Isoli Daidhayo, who is a special contributor. And they do have that paragraph, why we wrote this. In Senegal, poverty makes young people embark on a dangerous voyage to reach Europe. Parents and local leaders are seeking solutions to encourage them to stay. Okay, this is from Joao and Thaya Roy Sir Mur, Senegal, and La Orotava, Canary Islands. Pape Sadie's teenage sons left in the dark. One morning in 2020, he woke up and Abdoulaye and Soleimani weren't there. He waited 2 days, then three. He asked around, but deep down he already knew. Pepe had warned them about the risks of the perilous days at sea. After all, he'd made the trip to the Canary Islands himself over a decade ago. For over a week, I couldn't eat or sleep, he recalls from the courtyard of his sister's home in a seaside town of Joao, once a popular departure point for migration to Europe. I knew the route, and that it shouldn't have taken so long. Nearly 64,000 people arrived illegally in Spain in 2024, with a record 46,843 landing in the Canary Islands, the country's closest point to Africa. From the West African coast, according to the Spanish Interior Ministry. Aid groups say an additional 10,457 people died or disappeared trying to reach Spain that year, most of them attempting the Atlantic route from West Africa, whose strong currents have made it the most dangerous sea crossing in the world for migrants. Many were departing coastal towns and villages like João, where families who once relied on the sea for jobs now struggle to put food on their table, as industrial fishing increasingly puts traditional fishermen out of work and strips the ocean of precious resources. But as Pepe knew only too well, if the risks of leaving are clear, so are the rewards. Nestled among João's simple concrete homes and dirt lanes are stately, fresh, painted two-story houses built with money sent home from migrants. This tempts those who can't make ends meet with the promise of a life in Europe. Last year, remittances accounted for 11.6% of Senegal's gross domestic product, according to the World Bank. Many here say it's better to die at sea than next to the sea because you didn't have enough to eat, said Mostafa Diouf, a local anti-migration activist who is trying to convince young people like Abdoulaye and Soline Main Sadie to remain in Senegal. 2 decades ago, when Mr. Diouf himself boarded a boat bound for Europe, he had felt that same tug. Now, as Senegal's coastal villages empty out of their young people, he is trying to make the opposite pitch. Stay and try to build something better here instead. The stakes of this fight are calculated in the lives of those like Abdoulaye and Soline Main, the stability of fishing communities like João, and even the future of this country. At a time when Senegal looks to build its industries and assert independence from the West, the country needs its young people. But leaders, activists, and parents face an uphill battle to keep them at home. International migration is growing, and historical evidence suggests that as poorer countries approach middle-income status, people tend to leave more often, not less. Senegal now faces a quandary affecting countries across the region. When the promise of Europe burns so bright, what would it take to keep young people at home? I told Abdoulaye and Soline Main, "Watch out, it's not better over there," says Pepe. But they were stubborn and determined. They went anyway. Luckily, they survived. Abdoulaye Sadie didn't want to disappoint his father, but he knew he couldn't stay. He worked as a hairdresser in João and fished with his dad and brother on the weekends. Still, he found himself calling his mother in mainland Spain each month, asking her to wire him cash. In Europe, he thought he could earn more and help his family out. When Abdoulaye boarded the wooden fishing boat along with 180 others that day in 2020, he knew the risks, but he had grown up on the water. The waves didn't scare him. Nothing prepared him, however, for the harrowing voyage to the Canary Islands. The trip was supposed to take 5 days, but halfway there, the boat got lost. After a week at sea, it ran out of gas. The passengers could see the Canary Island of El Hierro, which their phone's GPS told them was only 11 miles away. But they were trapped, the last of their food and water gone. For 4 days, the boat drifted agonizingly towards the shore. In desperation, some people drank seawater and became violently ill or dehydrated. When his fellow passengers began to die, Abdoulaye watched as they were thrown overboard. "I couldn't look at the sea for a long time after that," he says from a hillside cafe in La Orotava on the Canary Island of Tenerife. "Every time I would go to the beach there, I'd always thought of that trip, of the people who died." Like many young men who leave Senegal, Abdoulaye grew up in a fishing family. Each evening, Pepe came home with fresh fish for dinner. But by the time Abdoulaye began joining him on fishing trips as a teenager, they often returned empty-handed. The family's problem is one that faces fishing communities along the length of Senegal's coast, where the majority of fish populations are in a state of collapse, according to a report by the Environmental Justice Foundation. Small-scale fishers like the Sadies have seen their catch decrease by over half in recent years and say their living conditions are also plummeting. One of the main culprits is the industrial fishing boats roaming the Senegalese coast, dragging tens of thousands of tons of fish into their nets each year. While most of these ships are registered as Senegalese, many are in fact controlled by foreign investors from Europe and China, and often flout restrictions on where they can catch and how much. That has squeezed the local fishing industry and also altered the way Senegalese eat. Traditionally, fish has been a centerpiece of local diets and a star attraction of beloved dishes like the thaiboudaini, a plate of stewed white fish served over a bed of rice and vegetables. But as Senegalese fish exports quadrupled between 2008 and 2018, the amount of fish available to households here fell by half, according to a 2022 study in the journal Marine Policy. Losing fish means losing tradition, U.S.-based Senegalese chef Pierre Thiam told the Associated Press. In November 2024, the European Union announced that it would not be renewing an agreement with Senegal that allowed European boats to fish surplus stocks in Senegalese waters in exchange for yearly payments of around $1.8 million. Although European boats are responsible for only a small proportion of the total catch in Senegalese waters, many Senegalese see the end of the EU agreement as a positive sign for the local fishing industry, in particular traditional fishers. Compared to 2 years ago, we're already seeing a difference, says Abdourahmane Diouf, a member of Joël's CLPA, the local artisanal fisheries council. Revenues are going up. Marine life, especially octopus and sardines, is starting to come back. But for small-scale fishermen, so far, little has changed. Inside the Joël port on a recent morning, men in rubber boots scurry around, sorting fish and packing them into refrigerated trucks destined for the international market. But local authorities estimate that nearly 90% of fishermen in the area work in the artisanal sector, and out on the beach, dozens of their wooden fishing boats sway idly near the shore. Meanwhile, fishermen crouch under the awning of a building with nowhere to go. Three women attempting to sell octopus say they do so in vain. Most middlemen will end up buying from the big industrial boats. Pepe still tries to go out to sea each day with his 16-year-old son, Ibrahima, who dropped out of school to help his dad fish. Together, they catch miniature sharks to sell to hotels and clients in Ghana. Whatever the pair doesn't sell, they exchange for fish to feed their family of 10. In addition to Abdoulaye and Soleimane, Pepe's eldest son and his first wife live in Bilbao, Spain, where she earns a living braiding tourists' hair. In good times, Abdoulaye sends a few hundred euros to his father, enough to pay for the family's food for a month. But inflation and poor job prospects means it's getting harder and harder for any of them to send money home. Meanwhile, Pape's two other wives work odd jobs, collecting plastic garbage from the beach and selling it to recycling centers, or selling small amounts of fish at the port. "We have enough money to eat, not much else," he says, crossing his arms on a low bench in the courtyard while a sheep bleats in the next room. "I can never relax. There are so many mouths to feed." But although Pape struggles to provide for his family, his friends and neighbors call him the little rich guy because he has sons in Europe. His second wife has started pleading with him to allow Ibrahima to migrate to Europe so she can have a child who's made it too. "If Ibrahima comes to me one day and says he wants to leave on a boat, I'll refuse," says Pape, shaking his head. "If his brothers can sponsor him for a visa, maybe," he says, "but on a boat, no way." The promise of legal status is one of the key factors driving so many Senegalese migrants towards Spain in particular. The country has long had more open policies towards new arrivals than many of its European neighbors. In May, its government simplified the procedure for obtaining residency and work permits. It has also expanded its circular migration program, which provides short-term visas for West Africans to come to Spain for seasonal work, mostly in agriculture, before returning home. But the number of people who qualify for the circular migration program, which involves a lengthy interview process, remains small. And because it doesn't provide a longer-term perspective, people don't get enough skills to invest back in Senegal, says Ravenna Sost, a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, Europe. For migrants who are able to remain in Spain, meanwhile, there are other challenges. Far-right and anti-immigrant parties have gained ground across Europe, including some regions of Spain. Despite the country's open policies, polls show a growing majority of Spaniards support the deportation of both unauthorized migrants and those with legal status who commit crimes. Abdoulay says he has at times experienced horrible racism and battled assumptions that migrants like him are only in Spain to benefit from the country's social security net instead of working to integrate into Spanish life. He just wants to be treated as a normal person, he says, but instead, everyone thinks all black people just got off the boat. Many unauthorized migrants also remain stuck working low-paying, under-the-table jobs that don't make them enough money to send home, much less pay their own bills. Families think you arrive in Europe and it's an El Dorado, but it's exactly the opposite, says Alioune Fall, president of Sama Chance. The Dakar-based nonprofit provides newly returned migrants with temporary housing and psychological support to help them reintegrate into Senegalese life. Some people have had very intense experiences. Many have been exploited, says Mr. Fall. They're ashamed to return to their families and say, it didn't work out. Mustapha Diouf, the migration activist, is determined to stop young people from leaving Senegal in the first place. In 2006, he was one of more than 30,000 people who left West Africa for the Canary Islands, part of a historic migration wave that lasted until 2008. The majority came from Senegal, where global price shocks collided with an erratic rainy season that led to low crop outputs for farmers. But soon after his arrival, Mr. Diouf was imprisoned and deported back to Senegal. Upon his return, he set up the nonprofit AJRAP, which is the Association of Young Repatriates, and has since become an outspoken voice against migration. From his home in Thiaroye-sur-Mer, an impoverished fishing village outside Dakar, Mr. Diouf makes the rounds in schools and community centers across Senegal to spread the word about the dangers of migrating by sea. People here are very poor, he says, but we shouldn't have to do this. Mr. Diouf's campaign is part of a wider effort to reduce both the push and pull of migration. In October of last year, the EU announced that it was giving Senegal 30 million euros, and that's about $34 million, to help prevent illegal migration to its shores. The money will go towards stopping departures and human trafficking, supporting sea rescues, and educating people about the dangers of migrating by sea. At the same time, Senegal's Marine Corps has been tracking its waters for illegal fishing, which equally helps detect boats headed for Spain. The EU has also spent more than 160 million euros, or about $185 million, in Senegal since 2015, on efforts to address the root causes of migration, like poverty, poor governance, and insecurity. But the impact has been inconclusive. Now, activists like Mr. Diouf are pushing Senegal's national government to do more to convince young people to stay. He says not enough of the money promised for education and job training is actually reaching Senegalese communities. Meanwhile, in towns like Joal and Thiaroye-sur-Mer, the lure of Europe and what it can offer continues to separate the haves and the have-nots. In these towns, most residents live in weathered homes made of sand and clay that flood every time it rains, where flies buzz over fresh meat in open-air courtyards because refrigerators are too expensive. Wooden pirogue boats idle in the bay while young people do odd jobs, rolling car tires across town or selling bags of tap water to help their parents make ends meet. But on nearly every corner, fancy houses tower above their neighborhoods. Inside are televisions and washing machines purchased with money sent from abroad. Those with family in Europe sport Nike brand track suits and shoes. They didn't worry, or they needn't worry, how the electricity and water bills will get paid at the end of the month. More patrols in Senegalese waters have largely stopped young people from boarding empty fishing boats in coastal towns like Joal and Thiaroye-sur-Mer, say local authorities. But the restrictions have only pushed them into the hands of smugglers on the coast of Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, and Mauritania. Obviously, these kids don't want to risk their lives, says Mr. Doyoff, crouching next to a pirogue canoe at Thiaroye-sur-Mer's beach. They're just motivated to have a better life. Back in Tenerife, Abdoulaye has a temporary residency permit and is trying to move forward. He's training to be a chef and works as a translator from Spanish to Wolof to help Senegalese arrivals with the challenges of adjusting to their new European life. His brother, Soleimane, recently moved to El Hierro with his Spanish wife, who is pregnant with their first child. But Abdoulaye says their lives in the Canary Islands have at times been extremely hard. He often struggles to pay his rent for the apartment he shares with a handful of other men from Joal. And every time he goes to the store, it feels like prices have gone up again. This fall, he had a bike accident, hurt his wrist, and hasn't been able to work since. Abdoulaye tries to convince his little brother, Ibrahima, to be sensible, to wait for his brothers to send him an invitation to come to Spain on a tourist visa or through the family reunification process. It's not just for Ibrahima's sake, but for Pepe's too. Abdoulaye grew up hearing his father's painful migration story. He'd set off for Europe on a fishing boat, working illegally at a Spanish port while their mother struggled back in Joal to take care of Abdoulaye and Soleimane, just toddlers then, by herself. I keep telling my brother to be patient, to wait for the paperwork to go through. We will buy you a plane ticket, says Abdoulaye. Don't come by boat. It's madness. But for Ibrahima, the desire to have what his brothers do in Europe rings louder. Life is really hard here, he says, just out of earshot from his father, back in Joal. There's no time to go out, only to go fishing and get enough money to eat. I want to be able to buy things, like shoes and nice clothes. Pape knows what his son dreams of, and it keeps him awake at night. Already each morning when he goes to wake Ibrahima for another day at sea, he pauses at his bedroom door, wondering if his son will still be there. Right now, Ibrahima is young. He still listens to me, Pape says. But once he gets older, he'll stop taking my advice. I know he's going to leave one day, too. And there's a note here. It says, Colette Davidson and Isuli Daidhayu, reporter from Joal and Thiaroye-sur-Mer, Senegal, and Ms. Davidson from La Orotava, Tenerife. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. All right, now for an article in the Humanity Behind the Headlines section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. We've got something called Boat Strikes Off Venezuela Mark Shift in 54-Year U.S. War on Drugs. This is written by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent, and they do have that paragraph why we wrote this. Richard Nixon's war on drugs entailed a degree of U.S. pressure on foreign allies, but the Trump administration's strikes on suspected drug smuggling boats off Venezuela charts a new course of non-cooperation. From Mexico City, on a June day in 1971, President Richard Nixon stood behind a podium by an American flag and declared drug abuse to be the United States' public enemy number one. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive, Mr. Nixon announced. This will be a worldwide offensive dealing with the problems of sources of supply. The U.S. war on drugs, launched during that speech, has endured through Republican and Democratic administrations for more than five decades. President Donald Trump has opened the most recent chapter in that war, ordering military strikes against boats suspected of smuggling drugs from South America and positioning the USS Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier near the Venezuelan coast. But one traditional element of U.S. drug policy has been missing from Mr. Trump's actions: international cooperation. Historically, Washington has carried out almost all its drug war operations in Latin America with buy-in from regional governments. Whether they involve Colombian or Mexican forces tracking down a kingpin with an assist from U.S. intelligence and training, or U.S. aid to pay for local government action, a long line of American officials have considered this war possible only with foreign governments' involvement. Most of the time throughout the history of the drug war, the U.S. has sought to cooperate with Latin American governments to get them to reduce production or reduce trafficking through their national territories, says Renata Keller, an expert on drug and security policies in Latin America at the University of Nevada, Reno. Some of it has been somewhat coercive, she adds, but it always has been under the guise of a cooperative effort. Last month, both Britain, which has a handful of territories in the Caribbean, and Colombia announced that they had suspended some intelligence sharing with Washington because of U.S. strikes against small boats thought to be smuggling drugs. If the U.S. were to resort to military action within Venezuela's borders, Dr. Kelly says it would be clear that we're not seeking to cooperate anymore in the war on drugs, and it would almost certainly provoke a backlash in the region. A new rupture. In Colombia, cooperation is already unraveling. For the first time since 1997, the U.S. administration declared in September that Colombia was falling short in the war on drugs and started the process to decertify Bogota as a drug control partner. That move will deny Colombia more than $100 million per year in funds used to fight drug trafficking and insecurity, according to calculations by Michael Weintraub, director of the Center for the Study of Security and Drugs at the Universidad de los Andes in Bogota. If you're the United States, you definitely want Colombian cooperation in fighting drug trafficking, says Dr. Weintraub, because Colombia produces about 70% of the world's cocaine. Successive Colombian governments have been in lockstep with U.S. administrations for the past 40 years, says Dr. Weintraub. Now the Trump administration has changed the rule book. The uncertainty over international cooperation has increased dramatically, he says. One of the few examples of the U.S. going it alone in the drug war was its 1989 operation in Panama to remove then-President Manuel Noriega, a known drug trafficker. But despite his surrender to U.S. forces, dozens of people were killed, and it made little difference in drug trafficking operations into the United States. It also served as something of a turning point for direct U.S. meddling in the region. For decades, U.S. officials have intercepted suspected drug trafficking boats in Latin American and Caribbean waters, seizing drugs, detaining suspects, and frequently prosecuting them. But never before have they blown them out of the water as military targets. From September 2nd through mid-November, the U.S. forces conducted an estimated 21 boat strikes in international waters, killing more than 80 people. Officials in Washington said the boats were carrying drugs and posed a direct threat to national security, but they have provided no evidence to support these claims. Latin Americans' views of the Trump administration's actions are mixed. In Ecuador, voters in a referendum in November turned down a government proposal to base foreign troops in the country, troops that who could help combat the rise of transnational organized crime there. The referendum result was seen as a sign of public mistrust for U.S. intentions in the region. Others have backed the Trump administration's boat strikes and its hostile statements seemingly aimed at weakening Venezuela's authoritarian leader, Nicolas Maduro. The Venezuelan opposition leader and recent Nobel Peace Prize winner, Maria Corina Machado, told Bloomberg in October that any deaths from boat strikes should be blamed on Mr. Maduro. The U.S. and Venezuela have been at odds for decades, says Dr. Keller, but I think a respect for non-intervention and self-determination has restrained other recent U.S. leaders from directly attacking Venezuela or its people. The State Department is expected to soon designate a Venezuelan drug operation, the Cartel de los Soles, which Washington claims is led by Mr. Maduro, as a foreign terrorist organization. That would mark the 12th Latin American drug cartel so designated since Mr. Trump took office. Some analysts believe it could pave the way for direct U.S. strikes against illegal organizations outside U.S. territory. Closer to home, so far, more than half of the cartels categorized as terrorist groups in the region are based in Mexico. A lot of people are extremely worried that direct armed attacks against cartels inside Mexico could be the next step, says David Sacedo, a Mexican security analyst. Between 2008 and 2021, the U.S. funneled some $3 billion through the Mérida Initiative into Mexico and Central America to fund cooperative counter-narcotics and border security programs. The plan did not reduce drug trafficking from Mexico or arms trafficking from the U.S., but as former U.S. Ambassador to Mexico, Roberta Jacobson, said in 2021, it created a culture of security cooperation. Washington has threatened economic sanctions in a bid to encourage the Mexican government to adopt a stricter approach to fentanyl production and trafficking. Last December, 1 week after Mr. Trump threatened 25% tariffs on the country's exports, Mexican authorities discovered more than a ton of fentanyl pills, a record seizure. Mr. Saucedo does not expect U.S. military action on Mexican territory, in large part because Mr. Trump's strategy in Mexico is working for him. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week it's entitled, The Fight Over Cashless Bail, What You Need to Know. And there you have that paragraph, why we wrote this. Cashless bail is meant to ensure low-income people don't have to stay in jail pre-trial unless a judge deems them dangerous. President Donald Trump says the system itself is dangerous and is pressuring cities and states to end it. This is written by Troy Aiden Sabajan, who is a staff writer. The issue of cashless bail is back on lawmakers' minds as President Donald Trump's allies in the House of Representatives passed legislation in mid-November that would, in certain cases, ban the reform that releases low-risk defendants without money payments before trial. The president and his supporters claim the practice puts the public in danger from potentially harmful individuals who may reoffend. In late August, the president signed two executive orders, one directing federal officers in the District of Columbia to seek pretrial detention for offenders to the fullest extent permissible, and another threatening to withhold federal funding from cities and states that have largely eliminated cash bail. The Department of Justice has yet to release an anticipated list of places it's targeting for the use of cashless bail. Meanwhile, a bill introduced by Elise Stefanik, a Republican congresswoman from New York, that would prohibit cashless bail in Washington, D.C., was passed by the House November 19th over the objections of leaders of the district who urged Congress to reject the effort as federal overreach. The bill now is under consideration by the Senate. Ms. Stefanik has also introduced a bill to end cashless bail nationwide. Now, what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: what is cashless bail? Answer: traditionally, bail money is posted by defendants to secure their release before trial. Because it is a refundable deposit, it serves as a kind of insurance that defendants will return to court. Critics say the system punishes the poor. Wealthier defendants can more easily post bail, while low-income people might have to stay in jail sometime for months. Cashless bail reforms aim to address this issue by replacing money bail with risk-based or individualized assessments. Judges decide whether someone should be detained or released based on factors like public safety and flight risk, not their ability to pay. Question: why is the White House targeting it? Answer: President Trump has seized on high-profile crimes by people released pre-trial, incidents amplified in conservative media to claim there is a revolving door in the justice system. In Charlotte, North Carolina, a man with a long arrest record was freed on a written promise to appear in court, a form of cashless bail, before allegedly fatally stabbing 23-year-old Irina Zarostka, a Ukrainian refugee, on a light rail train in August. The killing became a rallying cry for opponents of bail reform who argue that repeat offenders are slipping through the cracks with little accountability. Federal agents from the Department of Homeland Security arrived in Charlotte in mid-November in a highly publicized campaign against both illegal immigration and crime. The suspect in Ms. Zarutska's murder is a U.S. citizen, not an unauthorized immigrant. But Republican state lawmakers and federal officials are using the case to highlight concerns about crime and Mecklenburg County's sanctuary policies. The president has also used cases like that of Ms. Zarutska to portray bail reform as the radical left's fantasy that has turned American streets into hunting grounds for repeat criminals. But researchers say these examples are outliers. Study after study has found that the overwhelming majority of defendants released without bail appear in court and do not reoffend while awaiting trial. Question: can the president overrule state bail reforms? Answer: no. The federal government can't override state criminal procedure. But Republican lawmakers are considering legislation to tighten pretrial release rules in New York and Texas past limits on cashless bail this year. In North Carolina in September passed Irina's Law, which eliminates cashless bail for certain violent crimes and repeat offenders. Some rules reintroduce money bail for certain offenses or allow judges more discretion to weigh whether a defendant might pose a danger to himself or others. As the White House could try to punish states and cities financially, legal experts say withholding federal funds or issuing fines over bail policy is likely to spark lawsuits. In recent months, courts have struck down similar attempts by the Trump administration to overrule states on various issues, including sanctuary city practices, education policies, and immigration enforcement. There's certainly a chance of litigation, says Charlene Grace, a deputy public defender in Cook County, Illinois. The courts have stopped many of the president's attempts to use unrelated funding as a way to punish states and municipalities with policies he doesn't like. Question: what does the evidence say about whether cashless bail works? Answer: several states and jurisdictions have curtailed the use of money bail for low-income, low-risk defendants over the past decade, including Alaska, California, Illinois, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, and Washington, D.C., promoting alternatives like supervised release. But after violent crime rose sharply in the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, many politicians, police leaders, and pundits were quick to blame bail reform. In several studies, researchers have found no correlation between bail reform and higher crime rates. In 2024, the Brennan Center for Justice conducted a study of 33 cities across the country to assess the causal impact of bail reform on crime trends. The study found no statistically significant relationship between bail reform and crime rates. Illinois became the first state to fully eliminate cash bail in September of 2023. Over the next year, violent crime fell by 12%, and jail populations declined by 14%, and court appearance rates remain high at 95% overall and 98% for violent felony cases. In Chicago's Cook County, homicides dropped 16% and shootings fell 23% compared with pre-reform levels, while 84% of people released pre-trial were not charged with any new offense and 94% were not charged with new violent crimes. Experts caution against drawing a straight cause and effect line. Some studies focus directly on defendants released without bail, while others track broader trends in crime. The president is right that the current system is broken, but wrong about the solutions, says Jeremy Cherson, communications director at the Bail Project, an advocacy nonprofit. Criminal justice experts point to interconnected issues like mass incarceration, uneven sentencing among racial and socioeconomic groups, overcrowded and underfunded jails, and overuse of plea bargains as contributors to larger systemic problems. We know bail reform is working. It reduces unnecessary jail time, strengthens court appearance rates, and makes communities safer. And the final question, what's next? And the final answer, if the president moves to withhold federal funds based on his executive orders, states will likely sue. States like Illinois say their laws remain unaffected by the executive orders. President Trump's executive order on August 25th directed the Department of Justice to provide a list within 30 days of places that have substantially eliminated cash bail for crimes that pose a clear threat to public safety and order. If that list is released publicly, it is expected to escalate legal fights and set up another test of how much power Washington has to shape local criminal justice policy. And now we find ourselves in the home forum section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There is one article and there is one poem, and I will read both. The article is entitled, More Than I Bargained For, From Underestimating to Overpaying, My Failed Adventures in Haggling. And this is written by Robert Close. My father was a world-class dickerer. As a young boy, I remember looking on as he bargained with the owner of a sporting goods store over a fishing rod he wanted to buy for my birthday. The clerk engaged patiently with my father as the two went at it. In the end, my dad prevailed and garnered a 25% discount. His argument was that the metal fishing line guides were poorly angled. He also got the clerk to throw in an extra spool of fishing line. For my part, I was embarrassed. Bargaining for something that has a plainly marked price seemed somehow wrong. As we walked along the street, I asked my dad if the man was mad at us. He looked down at me and smiled. Of course not. If he didn't want to sell this rod at a price I had bargained for, he would have said so. And said no. Then he chuckled. That man enjoyed the back and forth as much as I did. With the benefit of hindsight, I realized that my dad was right. There are those who love the art of bargaining. There are even countries where it is built into the culture. Over the years, I tried my best to emulate my father, and I concluded that dickering ability is not hereditary. I stink at it. I was 17 years old when I made my first independent attempt to haggle on a class trip to Spain. The street vendors expect you to bargain with them, our teacher, Mr. Gursk, told us. And so, on a brilliant Madrid day, I decided to make my father proud. I spotted a street vendor with a brimming display of sunglasses. In my halting high school Spanish, I approached him and picked out an attractive pair. In an offhand manner, he quoted me the American equivalent of the local currency, $5. Mr. Gersk had told us to commence the dickering by offering half the stated price. Being an attentive student, I offered the man $2.50. I was taken completely by surprise when he flew off the handle and began to wave at me and berate me. I upped my offer to $3, then $3.50, then $4.50. The man told me I was insulting him. The price is now $6, he said, holding up six fingers for emphasis. I don't know what possessed me, but I forked over the $6. When I got back to the hotel, Mr. Gersk listened to my story. You're supposed to bargain down, he said, agreeing not to tell my classmates about my embarrassing dickering gambit. Over the years, I made further attempts to bargain, almost always with negative results. Regardless of where I travel, my efforts rarely bear fruit. On a recent trip to El Salvador, I was looking for a leather wallet for my son. I found the perfect item, embossed with a Salvadoran theme. The man quoted me a price of $10. I offered him $6. Looking pained, he placed his hand on his heart, then called his little boy out of the back room. The child emerged, sucking on his fist as he sniffed back tears from some scrape. The upshot, I gave the man $10, and I threw in an extra buck for some candy for the little boy. I recall my dad once confiding the secret of successful bargaining. You've got to convince the vendor that you don't need whatever it is they're selling. Get the stars out of your eyes. Learn to walk away. Again, my dad was right. It was my mother who once told me, "You have soulful, trusting eyes." As it turns out, my eyes have worked wonders for building relationships, but as for commerce, I've wound up paying top dollar for everything. A couple of years back, I had a delightful student from Turkey in my university class where I teach. "You must go to Istanbul," she gushed. "You can bargain your heart out in the Grand Bazaar. What great deals!" Yes, for anyone else. But once the Turks see my soulful eyes, I wouldn't stand a chance. Okay, pause for poetry. They got one poem here. It's called Nocturne. This is written by Andrew Armstrong. The moon was once a pirate queen who brought along a treasure chest when she climbed the clouds to heaven. She lifts the lid where the day is done, arrays her gems against a cloak of night. Rivers become bracelets in her light. They twine about the arms of earth, spill into seas turquoise and emerald, endlessly generous with her riches. The moon casts diamonds upon the water. Our eyes grasp with what our hands cannot. Together we share what none can possess. At dawn, the moon gathers up her gems and places them back in the chest. A Midas sun turns to gold, the shimmering surface of things. But hers is the triumph of silver evenings. The moon, this winsome lady. And finally, we find ourselves in the Monitor's View section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are two of them. And here we go with the first one. Generosity as a climate action driver. Perhaps the biggest news out of this year's global climate conference was not more government promises to reduce carbon emissions. Rather, it was a new survey by the Climate Works Foundation that highlights generosity at the heart of the climate action. Private donations to help people adapt to climate change more than doubled from 2021 to 2024, hitting a record $870 million according to the survey. Meanwhile, the number of foundations making adaptation-related grants jumped by more than 50%. During the two-week conference itself, more than 35 philanthropic institutions agreed to spend $300 million on meeting the health needs of those most vulnerable to droughts, floods, storms, or heat waves. And the Gates Foundation announced a $1.4 billion project to expand access to innovations that help farmers across sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. The actual amount of all this new giving, which donors admit is far less than what is needed, is not really the focus. Instead, private donors are essential because they are more risk-tolerant and creative in putting money into showcase climate projects than risk-averse leaders in business and government. In a time of accelerating climate impacts, shrinking civic space, and fragile global cooperation, philanthropy's voice and support matter more than ever, wrote Nancy Lynn Borg, head of the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. She also stated that many climate solutions can both curb emissions and help communities adapt. Adaptation goals were first established at the 21st UN Climate Change Conference a decade ago in Paris. That same meeting also produced a global agreement to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Since then, many of the world's biggest private donors have been organizing around climate action. People want to give money to help solve this problem but don't know what to do, so they're faced with decision paralysis, stated Dan Stein, executive director of Giving Green, an organization that helps individuals, businesses, and philanthropies make effective donations to combat climate change. Private giving and public spending on climate change, he told Triple Pundit, which reports on sustainability in business, can complement each other. Now here is the second and last Monitor's View article. Lawful checks on drug traffickers. President Donald Trump's military approach to cocaine traffickers in the Americas keeps hitting bumps. His assistance to the armed forces in Colombia, the largest source of cocaine, has slowed because of a feud with that country's leftist leader. In a referendum, voters in Ecuador, through which some 70% of global cocaine flows, rejected the idea of foreign bases in the country to help fight the drug trade. And in recent months, as the United States military has built up forces near Venezuela and conducted lethal strikes against alleged drug-carrying boats, cries have grown louder that such attacks might violate international law. Meanwhile, amid this forceful approach, one country in the Caribbean, the Dominican Republic, has received an accolade for an alternative tactic to dealing with crime, whether it is petty theft or international drug runners coming to its shores. A global ranking of countries on democratic rule of law found the Dominican Republic had the highest increase this year, it says 2.1%, in the overall scoring for areas from judicial independence to police performance to civic participation. That was up from a 1.1% improvement the year before. While its overall rank is still number 76 out of 143 countries, the Caribbean's second biggest country has become a model in how to make progress in democratic rule of law. More than two-thirds of nations, including in Latin America, saw a decline in their rankings this year. Which country had the lowest overall score in the rankings by the World Justice Project? Venezuela, a southern neighbor to the Dominican Republic and home to one of the world's worst authoritarian regimes. The process in the Dominican Republic began in earnest about two decades ago, but picked up speed in 2020 after an anti-corruption crusader, Luis Abinader, was elected president. Before his re-election in 2024, he acknowledged how much citizens have achieved in government transparency and accountability. "When you work with ethics and honesty," he said, "resources yield more and the possibilities of solving problems expand." In all societies, law itself is not as visible as, say, a drone attack on a boat. Yet it helps keep people away from illicit activities. As the late American legal scholar Harold J. Berman wrote, "A belief in law appeals not only to people's finite interests, but also to their faith and in a truth, a faith in a truth, a justice that transcends social utility." Perhaps the best armor against the drug trade can be found in places like the Dominican Republic, which is striving to anchor itself in qualities from honesty to equality. Well, we have a couple of minutes left, so I'll read from in the perspective section. There's something called Global Newsstand. What this is, it names a newspaper, where it's from, a headline, and a paragraph. So here we go. Arab news from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. The U.S. has a partner in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi-U.S. relationship has weathered storms, write Faisal Abbas, editor-in-chief. Despite political shifts between Republicans and Democrats, the strategic value of Saudi Arabia has remained constant. It is not a cash machine. It is a stabilizing force. As custodian of Islam's holiest sites, the region's largest economy, and a key player in global oil markets, Saudi Arabia is indispensable to U.S. interests. The U.S. needs a partner that commands respect in the region. Saudi Arabia fits that role. The emergence of a new Syria after decades of turmoil is testament to that influence. We got another one here from Le Monde in Paris. Brazil should live up to its climate pledge to indigenous people. Among protesters at the United Nations Climate Conference held in Brazil in November were many representatives of indigenous communities, writes Bruno Meyerfeld, Brazil correspondent. Their objective, to protest a decree that facilitates commercial navigation on several Amazonian rivers and which threatens their sacred sites. The summit was supposed to be a moment of recognition for indigenous peoples who have been placed at the heart of Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's political agenda. Lula's efforts have fallen short. The president has formally recognized only 16 indigenous territories, while 107 others are still awaiting approval. The protesters were determined to influence the outcome of the summit rather than play a merely symbolic role. And that was compiled by Victoria Hoffman and Audrey Thibert, who are staff writers. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. And thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.